Flash Kosh. He was an aged man, right-wing conservative, and not a very constructive reader. And he took an inordinate amount of time, part of President Fred's hand-holding conference and enjoying, soothing. One day he came to see President Fred, and he, W.J. Campbell was a conservative regent, elderly man, and not too helpful in directing the university's policy. He used up an inordinate amount of time, President Fred, but President Fred gave it to him patiently. One day he came to see President Fred and decided that what we needed was a loyalty oath, such as that had been enacted by the regents of the University of California. President Fred knew that the man that Mr. Campbell was most dependent on was Dean Middleton of the medical school. And he said, "Billy, why don't you go over and talk to Bill Middleton, see what he thinks of that idea." So Campbell hot-footed over to see Dean Middleton, who was a very strict disciplinarian, stern, able man, conservative, too. And so Campbell said what was on his mind. Dean Milton said, "Mr. Campbell, the first resignation you get will be mine." And that ended Campbell's advocacy of the Royal Eagle. The last thing I worked on for President Fred, again, was a very satisfying thing. This was the fight to get the library, Memorial Library. Under Governor Goodwin, I think it was a $12 million construction fund that had been allocated to the university for post-war construction. Well, the library committee was slow in formulating the plans for the new library, with the consequence that it looked like we might lose this money if we didn't go ahead and spend it. So President Fred had made the very hard decision of going ahead with the engineering building, using up money that had been allocated with the university for the library. And he had to sell this to the faculty. And he got Mark Ingram, whom he greatly respected, in some sense feared, because he felt that Dean Ingram had more strength with the faculty than he did. He got Mark Ingram to lead the selling job to the faculty to agree to postpone the library and go ahead with the engineering construction.
So the money wouldn't be lost.
And so the money wouldn't be lost. It was a calculated risk. Well, of course, people in the humanities, social sciences, were wanting the library first and engineering second, and were not happy with this decision. Well, they became even unhappier when, in the 49th session legislature, the appropriation for the library was defeated, killed. Now, Governor Rennebaum and his assistant, Professor William Young, were strong advocates of the library appropriation. And we had a conservative state senate, and the appropriation was defeated in the budget deliberations. So President Fred did what he knew he had to do. to stage a dramatic fight to restore this appropriation, $6 million. And after the victory was won, of course, there were many people who took credit for getting the library. But it was a relatively small band that met up there on Saturday and Sunday and worked out the strategy for the fight for the library. Balmer Sorensen, who was then director of university personnel, whose name I'm sure has been lost in university history, was very effective. He had many connections with the legislature. Tony Carrieri was very helpful. John Walsh, who was boxing coach and a lobbyist, was very helpful. Not helpful were the regents. The State Chamber of Commerce had opposed this appropriation, saying it would mean new taxes. Not helpful was the Alumni Association.
That surprises me.
I had the job of calling John Burgee, the director of the Alumni Association. I said, John, we're in a fight for our life here, and we've got to mobilize the Alumni Association. He said, Scott, that would tear my board apart. Many on the board are opposed to that library bill. I said, well, what the hell is an Alumni Association for if it isn't there when you need it? Well, he said, I've got to maintain the association and upset the board, cause it's leaving. He said, I'm not going to touch it. But John Burgee gave us no help. Leroy Luberg and I and Tony Carrieri and John Walsh, Bill Young and Governor Rennebaum deserve a very large share of the credit. The first thing I had done was to get Stanley Allen, president of National Case Register and a very loyal alumnus, was then president of the Alumni Association. And he turned over his public relations staff to us to prepare a booklet setting forth the case for the library. And it not only we used the public relations staff of National Case Register to design and prepare it, but they also, Stanley Allen also printed it as a contribution to the university. And it was well it was not printed with taxpayer money, because in the course of the library fight, a young state senator by the name of Melvin Laird came storming up to see President Fred and put this booklet on his desk and said, what right do you have to use taxpayers' money to put this kind of pressure on us? And President Fred said, you didn't read the last line. It was not printed with taxpayer money. I worked very hard working through editors and was able working through, for example, Shakes Jansen, managing editor of the Marinette Eagle Star, to get the senator from Marinette to change his vote, and we finally won that fight.
Which was sort of a breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Building.
You get into these problems. One senator said to me, he said, will you tell me why the university needs $6 million to build a building just to store books in? The lack of understanding of the importance of a library. I always got a kick out. One of the best lines I ever wrote for Dr. Fred was that when that fight was, he said, I've been put in a position of a dairy farmer with a 60 cow herd, but only a 20 cow barn. And several reporters legislators comment said, isn't that just like E.B. Fred talking that farm language?
But you wrote that?
I wrote that line.
That's nice.
And but he did, and President Fred did something. Again, he always underestimated how effective he could be. We finally got him to go down and start buttonholing legislators personally, and he was very effective. And the fact that he would come down and do this conveyed the urgency of the situation. I think the legislature was very effective. President Fred and Oscar Renavon and Bill Young were the prime movers in getting that library appropriation. And Roy Luberg and I and Tony Perry and John Walsh and Vollmer Sorensen, Clay Schoenfeld were the helpers. Really a turnaround for President Fred's administration.
I can appreciate the urgency. I've heard descriptions of the situation in the Historical Society before the library was built.
The University Library was moved into the new Historical Society building in 1900 on a temporary basis. They almost had the library in 1927, and then until somebody attached a rider to the appropriation to name it the La Follette Memorial Library. In this case, we were building a memorial for the veterans of World War II. Well, that's why it's Memorial Library. We weren't going to get into that difficulty. Well, let me move on down to, I was in a very difficult position in the 2 years I was working for President Fred. Because I had become convinced, as he earlier had become convinced, that the school of journalism had slipped. And this was one of the problems he had with establishing a relationship with editors in the state. They were greatly upset by the decline of the school of journalism. And President Fred had become convinced that new leadership was required to rebuild the school. And he saw the need to rebuild the school as a way of building better relationships with the press in the state.
But now, you earlier mentioned that Grant Hyde was the...
Grant Hyde was the director. But Grant Hyde, Willard Blyer pioneered the school of journalism and built a very strong school of national reputation. In fact, it was one of the strongest in the country. Journalism education in its first generation was dominated by two men, Waller Williams of Missouri, who took the trade school approach to journalism education, and Willard Blyer, who took the scholarly research approach to journalism education. By 1935, the soundness of the Blyer approach had been generally recognized. He came from a newspaper family, had a PhD in English, and was a scholar by nature and by mean. Whereas Waller Williams had come out, been a country editor, had not gone to a university, although he later became president of the University of Missouri. And these two men formed the patterns early, but by 1935, when Blyer died rather suddenly, he had built a very strong school here. Well, his assistant, Grant Hyde, who served Blyer well in handling the clerical work of departmental administration, which Blyer had no taste for, was made director. This led to the departure of Professor Chilton Bush, who later developed a very great program of journalism research and education at Stanford, of Ralph Nafsker at the University of Minnesota, of Ken Olson to Rutgers University, and others. So from 35 until 46, 47, the school had been declining in quality, although it still had a first-rate national reputation.
May I interrupt just a minute? It's my understanding that there was an effort to have Nafziger stay, and that there was some opposition to this. This is before he went to Minnesota. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. That, of course, occurred before I got here in 39, and I'm not sure of that, all that went on. I know Bush made some effort to oppose the appointment of Hyde, and I think, I'm told, made the mistake of enlisting students in that effort. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I had persuaded Dean Ingram to bring Henry Ladd Smith back. And Hank and I increasingly realized, felt frustrated in trying to strengthen school. Finally reached the conclusion that Hyde had to be replaced. Dean Ingram was very slow to accept this fact. When this struggle began, if either one of us had known it was going to take 2 years, I'm sure we would have left quietly rather than engage in it. But I was in the president's office and, of course, had to walk a very delicate line as his assistant, and not seemingly to interfere in internal school of journalism matters, yet I was also on the fact that the school of journalism created some awkward problems for me. But the thing that crystallized the decision to openly battle for new leadership was when Grant Hyde brought in a proposal for a course in sports writing. And which we were able to defeat in staff meeting. Then he took it to the executive committee for approval as a course, even though it did not have the support of the staff. And then, about the time this was occurring, a student by the name of Robert Solon, without any encouragement or knowledge on it, my part or Hank Smith's part, wrote a stinging letter to the editor of the Cardinal attacking the school of journalism as being out of date, inadequate. And this, along with the growing opposition of newspapermen in the state, Don Anderson of the State Journal, Fred Sappington of the Marinette Eagle Star, Irv Meyer of the Milwaukee Journal, and others, forced Dr. Fred to realize that change had to be made. And the problem was of persuading the staff, persuading Dean Ingram was to change it. He thought Dean Ingram was a very fair man, and he felt that Hyde was being criticized unfairly and perhaps operated against unfairly. He was slow to withdraw his support, what he ultimately did. And of course, Ralph Nafziger was the logical choice. I was the one that led the fight to bring Ralph back here and persuade him to come back here. And he did so with some reluctance. And he did so with some financial sacrifice. But for Ralph had such a deep sense of loyalty to Willard Blyer and to the University of Wisconsin, from which he had earned 4 degrees, that he felt obligated to come back and undertake the task of rebuilding the school, which he did and he brought it to the forefront by the early 1960s. So by 1948, Hyde was persuaded to resign, to step down as director under pressure from President Dean Ingram. And Hank Smith was appointed interim director. And then we concentrated on bringing NASCAR here, although we also interviewed Fred Merwin, who I mentioned earlier was a candidate. Dean Ingram rightly wanted to see more than one candidate. Fred Merwin was brought here for an interview, but then NASCAR. The efforts to negotiate with NASCAR and to bring him here were greatly complicated by great deal of premature publicity. The school journalism over the years has suffered from an excessive interest in the school by the news media, which is understandable. There's sometimes a damage. Okay.
Before we go on, I would be interested in knowing how your activities as Assistant to President Fred compared with those of Leroy Luberg, who came, I think, about the same time.
Yes, in a very real sense, Leroy Luberg succeeded Bill Sarles as President Fred's assistant and for academic and matters. And I was added as an assistant, same title, for public relations. I had the primary job of promoting the centennial, supporting the centennial observance, and of reorganizing information services on campus, and trying to coordinate, and supervise in a loose way, establish informational and public relations policies, whereas Luberg was concerned more with high school student relations, with handling of correspondence, although I handled a great deal of difficult correspondence, letters of a public that required or posed public relations problems were generally given to me by Lola Bradford or Ellen Neumann to draft a reply for. But Roy and I worked together closely and never had any great problem in overlap. Then when President Fred decided to move Dr. Baldwin up as vice president and open up the deanship in agriculture, he then set forth in the memorandum that both Leroy and I would report to Dr. Baldwin, something again he had discussed with us, and something in the end that never meant very much, because President Fred kept power in his own hands. He did not delegate much. And I would go see Dr. Baldwin, and he said, well, you better talk this over to the president, too. And generally, I found myself going back to the president, and so did Roy. Roy did a great deal of troubleshooting for the president. And incidentally, President Fred, you know, spotted talent very quickly and utilized it very quickly. He made Fine Singer had urged the appointment of Robin Fleming as director of the new Industrial Relations Center, has had this job of building an effective protective bridge over the school for workers. In prison, Fred quickly saw in Robin Fleming a very able troubleshooter, and he used him a great deal in that capacity. But he also used Leroy to deal with parents, to look into student personnel, student problems. And he operated more in the student area and in the correspondence area and the public speaking area than I did.
Well, eventually, of course, he became dean of students.
Yes. And he was moved around over the checkerboard a great deal before he was through. Anyway, I forgot to explain why I went back to full-time teaching. One of the conditions that Ralph Nafsker set down for his coming back here would be that I would return to full-time teaching. And I had not seen my career at that time as being in administration, so, and I was anxious to help get the school back on the track. So I went back in the fall of 49 full-time teaching and worked very closely with Ralph in trying to recruit more faculty and to get a research program going and that sort of thing, and to get our journalism institutes going. And I worked very closely with Ralph over those years. He was very supportive of him. About this, this is another period. In 1955 or thereabouts, I had a call from Cliff Lord, director of the State Historical Society. And Cliff said, "Scott, we have a letter here, H.V. Kaltenborn, offering to give us his papers. Why don't you come over and let's talk about this, see what we ought to do about it?" I was the person in school journalism that Cliff knew. And the more we talked, the more we realized that mass communication media are basically 20th century development. And the papers of most of the pioneers were still outside archives and still available. So we had a couple of subsequent conferences, and out of it came the Mass Communication History Center. And I suppose I look back over 30 years participating in its creation and development, probably the most satisfying thing, most enduring thing that I had a hand in around here. Set out to solicit the papers of pioneers, particularly those with Wisconsin connection, and we were successful in very early getting the papers of Louis Lochner, distinguished graduate of this university, Pulitzer Prize winning correspondent from Berlin, Marquis Childs, probably the most distinguished graduate of school of journalism, and others. I went after papers of public relations pioneers. My greatest accomplishment in that regard were getting the papers of William Baldwin, Arthur Page, and John Hill. It's been more difficult to get papers from public relations counselors than it has been from other areas of the mass media, because their cherished personal confidential relationship with clients. But over the years, doing a lot of begging, a lot of letter writing, a lot of traveling, society has built a very impressive collection of materials in the mass media, newspapers, radio, television, film, theater, public relations, and advertising.
Did you get the cotton burn papers?
Oh, yes.
What was his connection with the university?
None. He was a native of Merrill, Wisconsin.
I see.
And he thought that his state historical society should have first call on his papers. So in 57, summer of 57, one Sunday afternoon, Cliff Lord called me and said, you've been elected to the Board of Curators, State Historic Society. I said, Cliff, I'm not even a member. He said, well, you've got to join now. So I joined the board in fall of 57 and served on it until I did not stand for re-election this past June. 18 years service, including the
you were president at one point.
President,
you know?
From 64 to 67. And that was a very satisfying period. In that period, we completed the addition, got a federal grant of nearly $800,000 to, along with the state appropriation, remodel the old portion of the building. I appointed the first committee. Has eventuated in Old World, Wisconsin. But to give due credit there, I appointed that committee at the urging of Frederick Salmon, distinguished Milwaukee attorney and longtime member of the Board of Curators, who was the real power in the board so long as he served on it. I persuaded Don Schlichter to go out and raise $350,000 to help finance the definitive Wisconsin history now being prepared. We increased the society's membership substantially and made a number of forward strides in that period, of which I'm justifiably proud. Don't worry about that early. Service on the Board of Curators, particularly on its executive committee from 1964 on, gave me a great deal of satisfaction because the State Historic Society is outstanding among historic societies in the nation, helping contribute to the building, further building of a great American history library is very satisfying, particularly for one who is a frustrated historian at heart.
Now, from what I've learned, you have decided to leave the University of Wisconsin. And I would really like to know a little bit about why you have made this decision. I'm sure you must have had offers before this to leave.
Yes, I have. Over the years, I had a number of offers to leave. Perhaps the most tempting was in 1959, when I was offered vice presidency of one of the oldest and largest public relations counseling firms in the nation. Offered a job that would pay me more than three times what I was making at the time. Salary looked pretty big to a poor boy from West Virginia. But it was when I had that offer that I finally realized that I had just sort of accidentally stumbled into the only place that I belong, I think, where I'm happy. That is in a free university, teaching students, doing research, writing. I have to be free to express myself. And so that offer was a very healthy development. My understanding of myself and why I was so happy at the University of Wisconsin. Then in 1961, I had a very attractive offer at Northwestern University to take over its public relations and news editing courses, which I declined mainly because I didn't want to trade Madison for Metropolitan Chicago. Why I'm going to Georgia, of course, such a major decision, is a complex of factors. There are two main reasons. One was the attractiveness of the Georgia offer. The University of Georgia offered me the thing that I need most at this penultimate stage of my career. That is time to research and write. Several things I would like to accomplish before I quit. And the University of Georgia offered me what it calls a research professorship, which would involves a very light teaching load and thus a great deal of time for research and writing. Secondly, I had been growing over the past 3 years increasingly discouraged by the situation in the School of Journalism. Under Governor Lucey's budget cuts imposed upon the university, School of Journalism has been caught in the vice of increasing enrollment and decreasing support for staff and supply. Journalism is one of the three major growth areas currently in higher education across the country. Even though the staff of School of Journalism here has steadily tightened standards in order to control this steadily mounting, escalating enrollment, still, the school here finds itself with too few faculty members and too little supply support, inadequate supply support to meet the needs of students, particularly of the some 115 graduate students. Here, the graduate student load has gotten out of hand. And the teaching load is going to have to be increased. And this, of course, takes time away from research and writing. The last few years here, the teaching load, graduate student load, has been such that I haven't had adequate time to do the research and writing I wanted to do. This increasingly difficult work situation has led to the departure of 7 members of the faculty in the past 4 years. That perhaps, of course, is an oversimplification because the reasons people move from one institution to another are many and complex. In some cases it was personal, in some cases it was more attractive offer from another institution is against the work situation here. But I'm the 7th faculty member and 3rd sequence head out of 4 to leave in this lucid period. And, my last semester of teaching in Wisconsin, the first semester of the past academic year, I had 5 students complete master's theses and 2 PhD candidates move well along in their dissertation. For the reviewing, editing, criticizing of manuscripts for students takes a great deal of time, more time than the average citizen understands, I'm sure. Also, a as I reflect on my decision to go to Georgia, I realize that the stimulus for a new environment, new challenge, right as that word may be, at my age of 60, is a invigorating thing. I am happier and more highly motivated today than I have been in several years. I think it's an opportunity to help build a strong school of journalism at the University of Georgia. It's the stimulus of a new and different and dynamic environment. The University of Georgia is a very dynamic institution that's developing great strength and is on its way, I think, to national stature. And I find all this pretty exciting. And of course, I would be less candid to say that the fact I can play golf all winter in Georgia is a factor.
That's rather nice one, I can see.
It's not the major factor, as Governor Lucy indicated in a letter to me that he thought it was. So I am concerned about the school of journalism here. It's obviously, with the losses it suffered, lost three budget positions this year. It's obviously not as strong as it was in 1966 when Ralph Master retired. And, but it is still a very good school and one of the outstanding schools in the country.
In connection with Governor Lucy's policies, would you discuss what you consider the effect of merger has been?
Let me say that I worked very hard, diligently, for Governor Lucy's election in 1970. It did my wife and my son. My son drove for him. My wife did radio typing for him, solicited support and money for him. I thought he would be very good at the university. I have been consequently greatly disappointed in his policies as they affect the university. Overall, I think he has been a good governor for the state of Wisconsin. I see merger as bringing inevitably a homogenization of the state university system, which can only mean a leveling of the greatness, erosion of the greatness of the Madison campus. In today's newspaper, for example, we see comparison of the salaries of the Madison faculty with those in the other units in the state system. And,
they're higher in some
instances. Surprise that Madison professors are paid more than our professors, say, at Platteville or River Falls.
This is only full professors. So.
Yes, but all of this is going to lead to increasing pressure for equal pay for equal rank, whether you teach at Platteville or Madison. And this, of course, contributes to the erosion of Wisconsin's salary position vis-a-vis the strong universities of the nation, Big Ten, Berkeley, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, the schools with which Wisconsin must compete for first-rate faculty. The University of Georgia has found in the last 3 years that the most rateable universities in the nation are Michigan, Indiana, and Wisconsin. There are two of us who were here on the school ground, in fact, and now I'm teaching at the University of Georgia.
Who are they?
Vernon Stone and myself. Mm-hmm. So the strong hand of the central administration, the governance of the Madison campus, cannot help but lessen the autonomy and the strength of this campus. The central administration, of necessity, must serve equally all units of the system. This means the pressure is against allocating resources on the basis of need and purpose rather than on the basis of parity. The Madison campus has not achieved the autonomy that was promised during the merger debate. And the Madison campus finds itself increasingly frustrated by the rigid requirements of central administration. There's been a lessening of faculty governance, erosion of faculty governance, erosion of the Madison campus autonomy. None of these, along with the failure of university faculty salaries to keep pace with inflation, has led to, inevitably, to lessened morale situation on this campus today. It was the day Governor Lucey took office. In many conversations that I have had with the governor after he sprung the merger without any prior debate campaign, I detect that he feels he is catering in part to the political backlash against the university because of the troubled 60s we experienced. Also, he is a fiscal conservative and sees the need to bring the expanded growth of higher education in Wisconsin under more rigid control. And in this, I think he has a valid point. He is quite right when he insists that we have expanded the higher education establishment in the state beyond the needs and resources of the state. I fear he fails to appreciate what a great asset University of Wisconsin-Madison has been to this state as one of the nation's top five or so universities. It's still too early to tell what the ultimate effect of merger will be, but I have seen nothing thus far to persuade me that merger was a wise move. Yeah, I understand the governor's problem and the need for some central responsible body to determine allocation of priorities and resources in the state educational system, because the coordinating council was a dismal flop in that regard.
What do you think of the suggestion that was made this spring of possibly closing some of the two-year centers?
I think the proposal has merit. We are overextended in higher education in Wisconsin. I think we're suffering in some respects from the expansionism to very expansionist educational politicians, Eugene Lefee and Fred Harrington. Particularly, I think the former state colleges because of Eugene Fee's astute political leadership, were permitted to grow beyond the needs of the state. Fred Harrington certainly was motivated in part in developing UW-Green Bay and UW-Parkside and trying to build strong political base and populous Lakeshore area to counter the growing political strength of the state university system under Eugene Lefee. And Lefee, of course, countered our development of two-year centers with development of two-year centers for the state system, such as Richmond Center and Baraboo. I think we are overextended and there has to be some contraction with the resources of this state. Wisconsin, after all, is not a rich state. It's a state of 4 million persons, no great natural resources. Yet I am persuaded that it is not so poor that it cannot provide instruction for the number of students who want to study journalism. To cut three budget positions from a school that has a rising enrollment, not a decreasing one, makes no educational sense to me. But the returns from merger are not fully in, but they're certainly discernible evidence, it seems to me, that merger has hurt this campus more than it has helped. Now, it may have helped the other campuses more than it's hurt them, although I understand some of the most fervent advocates of merger in the old state university system are now having second thoughts about it. Let me elaborate a bit on the military education program, which I directed here from 1946 until I left end of 1974.
This is the summer program you mentioned?
No, there were two programs. As I mentioned earlier, Arthur Page, close friend and confidant of Secretary of War Henry Stimson, was asked to make a study of how the military could improve its public relationships in the post-war era. Mr. Page wrote a memorandum to Mr. Stimson and to Chief of Staff Dwight Eisenhower, which he said that the primary requirement for good public relations was competent public relations personnel. And he said, in effect, you have two choices. You can recruit civilians, public relations persons, practitioners, and try to teach them about the Army, or you can take Army officers and send them to school to study public relations. He said, I definitely recommend the latter. So General Eisenhower, acting on Mr. Page's recommendation, instituted a graduate program for Army officers to study public relations. Two institutions were selected, University of Missouri School of Journalism and University of Wisconsin School of Journalism. And as I mentioned earlier, the first three officers were assigned here summer of 1946.
Hey, Pop.